Welcome back to our 11 for 11 series of conversations with people who challenge and provoke ways of thinking about the most pressing issues of our time. Today, Dr. Raymond Tallis, whose new book, Aping Mankind, takes aim at pretty much the kind of scientific breakthroughs word of mouth often reports on. Now, we asked Jeff whether the emergence of reliable brain scan technology might rival DNA evidence in future trials. Here's what he said.
DNA is different. DNA isn't telling you what somebody thinks.
Does the brain scan of a psychotic person look different than that of someone who has a strong moral compass?
Take the psychopathy.
A long-held understanding of how our brains actually store and then access memory. Tell us about direct access.
So the old model of memory was that the brain is a bit
like
a hard
drive. Example by Professor Beatrice Luna. She teaches psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh and is a leader in the growing field of developmental neuroscience. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You'll find a link. Well, Ray Tallis is taking aim at what he calls a kind of neuromania, this assertion and a belief that biological destiny, backed up by brain science, is now guiding several different aspects of our life, not only in the sciences, but daily life and social policy. And as you say, Ray Tallis, in the humanities, what's your concern there?
I'm rather amazed that the humanities, in a sense, have collaborated with pseudosciences. And there are many humanities now that embrace the application of neuroscience to human life in a way that really seems to undermine their own ethos. Neuroaesthetics says that if you want to understand art, you should look what happens to the brain of people looking at bits of art. Neurolaw says if you want to make appropriate judgments in the court, then you should do brain scans on people who are accused of crimes. Neuroeconomics says if you want to understand why we make such unwise decisions, then we should look at the balance between the frontal lobe, which is prudent and tells us wait for it, and the amygdaloid body says I want it now, and so on and so forth. And it's rather surprising in a sense that the humanities have embraced neuroscience in this way. One of the founding concepts of the humanities was that individuals have a dignity, that they are conscious agents, not automatons in the grip of biological or indeed physical processes.
But don't these things, you know, musicology, maybe theology, have some sort of grounding in biology?
I don't think so. And I always find the neurological investigation of music extraordinarily barren. In fact, most research into what the music does to the brain fails to differentiate not only between J.S. Bach, for example, and Amy Winehouse. They both basically stimulate the dopaminergic pathways, apparently. But it fails to distinguish between the response to drugs or even sexual stimulus. And it seems to me that a science that cannot differentiate between hearing an organ played and having one's organs played with can't tell you much about either.
Well, a big concern for you is also that policymakers are embracing what you're calling neuromania. Paint a picture for us. What does that mean if played out to the nth degree?
Throw me into the briar patch. Yes, absolutely. Essentially, there's the idea that we shouldn't be thinking of politics of the right and the left anymore. We should be looking at politics of the right and the left hemisphere. That what we need is social policies that go with the grain of the brain, as it were. And I find that actually a matter of great concern. First of all, the fantasy that you could actually relate a social policy to definable activity in the brain. And secondly, that even if you could do that, it would be a good thing, as it were, to manipulate people through their brains to do what you consider to be the right thing. That the politician becomes a kind of neuro-shepherd to his neural flock is not only daft, but actually, if it was true, would be rather chilling.
I read a review of this book in The Guardian that said you are attempting to rescue atheism from the atheists. And I wonder, is there something inherently religious or even spiritual in your argument that there is something more than just biology that drives us?
I've been accused of lots of things. I've been accused of having a religious agenda, which I don't. I've been accused of being a creationist, which I'm most certainly not. I sign up to Darwinism. And I've been accused of being a dualist, so that I believe that we are kind of ghosts in the machine of the body, and I don't believe in that at all. My feeling is I'm just inviting people to look at what's in front of their nose, which is the most difficult thing, just to see how different we are from animals, and indeed to celebrate that, and also to acknowledge that our future is not something that can be explained by a biological script. The future lies in our own hands to shape. Humankind has been something that has shaped its own destiny rather than being shaped, as it were, by the biological prescription. And it's just saying, remember you have freedom. Remember that collectively and individually we make choices. Don't pretend for a moment that we are fated by our Darwinian heritage. There is evidence that we've actually broken away from biology. Of course, as a doctor, I know we are still organisms. You know, every time I eat a meal, I know that I'm an organism that requires nutrition. There's more to it than just nutrition. Meals are highly symbolic. The food I eat has been brought together from all the four corners of the earth and so on and so forth. So I'm just reminding people about the extraordinary, miraculous truths of humanity.
Is biologism the enemy of hope, to quote the title of your former book?
I think it is, if you think we are fated to enact a biological script. And some writers have made that very clear. I mean, there's a very eloquent political philosopher, John Gray, who said that we delude ourselves when we think we are different from animals. We delude ourselves when we think we can control our fate in the way that animals never do. In fact, if anything, we're not any animals, but we're terrible animals. And I think there is a profound pessimism built into the biological reduction of human beings. Some biologists would deny that. The brilliant primatologist Franz de Waal says we've got biological reasons for being cheerful about ourselves. You know, some chimps are jolly nice. But actually, if you look at the animal kingdom overall, most animals are jolly rotten to each other. They don't seem to fret over each other's fate. If you're trying to find sources of good cheer in the claim that we are to be understood biologically, you've got to be terribly pick and mix as to which beasts you choose to think we've inherited our propensities from. We take the biological givens and run with them to places that are not envisaged in biology at all.
Simon Shorvin of the UCL Institute of Neurology writes that all neuroscientists should read this book. Do you think you've changed any minds?
I haven't changed probably any current minds that are in the ascendant, but I'm vain enough to think that I might change the minds of those who are emerging in future. I've always thought my lottery ticket was in the 22nd century.
Dr. Tallis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Raymond Tallis, former doctor and professor, now full-time writer. His works include The Kingdom of Infinite Space, Enemies of Hope, and most recently, Aping Mankind, which we talked about today. To find more on the book and Dr. Tallis, and to hear more of our 11 for 11 series of conversations, visit wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for From Chinatown to Ghost Town, What's Behind Chinese-American Immigrants' Return to the Mainland, and Cultural Barriers to Treating Mental Illness. That's when Word of Mouth returns after the World News headlines. This is NHPR.